credit to Cable and Bridges in respecting the Hilton Pool. But I would want to credit to Kevin LeBron, who was doing this attention that he said it's the left of the road, the left of the road. There's a question about what happens if targets are not met. Firstly, I think what needs to be understood is that targets are just simply not targets, but in a sense, they are linked to issues of performance. Now, performance has got to be subjected to evaluation and assessment, both individually and also collectively in an organizational context. In other words, if you have a situation where a particular target or targets have not been met, the department owes itself an explanation as to why certain targets have not been met. The targets cannot, you know, some targets could not probably be met because, I'm just making an example, because of sheer underperformance. But you could also have a situation where a target is not being met precisely because of environmental questions as well as operating issues and so on. So all of those would have to take stock of them. But then, having said so, that in itself...
There's somebody who's receiving a call from the president. So let's give that person a chance to answer that call and then we continue.
But having said so, that in itself must still be subjected to a decision around the issue of performance management and so on. So that would be our response in so far as this question of targets has not been met, but also how we deal with them in the context of performance management and so on. The second area is that there's a concern about two things. I think the first one, insofar as ICT is concerned, the first one is about development of strategy. The second phase of the exit and transfer approach focuses on the issue of developing an ICT strategy. Now, I agree that ideally that's what the department should have had or should have been there in place or something like that. But the fact of the matter is that, therefore, we don't. We don't have that. So, and therefore, we have got to do this kind of work. And that work has already started in terms of developing an ICT strategy for the department. As to where do we stand with the Siemens PPP contract, that contract is valid up until the end of November 2012. So it only terminates at that particular point, and that's why we keep on referring to the issue of exit and transfer plan being in place, so that by the time the contract finally terminates, we were absolutely clear in terms of what it is that needs to happen to the department, about the department in relation to the issue of ICT. Lastly, there is a question which I think we need to be very careful in terms of how we deal with it, pertaining to NEDLAC. Firstly, just to say, you know, the relevance of NEDLAC can't be determined through a strategic plan. It's not possible. Because NEDLAC, its existence, was not brought about by a strategic plan. It was brought about by an overall assessment of the set of conditions prevailing at the time in the country that then led and bred and basically led to the birth of an institution called NEDLAC. Those of us that were perhaps still around at the time, and I think most of us were, at the time before there was the NEDLAC, I think there were even structures called NEF, for an example. Well, that was part of the first attempt to promote the issue of social dialogue in the country. But I think the policy debate still remains. and perhaps some of these questions that have been posed, they take us back to that issue. And many countries pre the First World War and post the First World War have been grappling with this question, the concept of social parliaments, as they used to refer to, as it used to be referred to. Now, the point being that some countries decided to stick with the concept of social parliament, some countries decided to abandon the issue of social parliament and so forth, precisely because I think amongst themselves they were also, you know, assessing their own obtaining conditions and so on, and then therefore determining whether a social dialogue structure is still relevant to their own needs. Now, and all I'm saying, Che, is that I think there needs to be a broader policy discussion, both at the level of government, business, and labor, on the issue of making NEDLAG relevant. And perhaps the issue that we should also be confronting would be, why do we think that social dialogue is not relevant? And why would we want to think that social dialogue does not have a direct contributory factor to the issue of developing and reconstructing the country? So those are some of the broader policy questions that I think just do not belong to the issue of a strategic plan for NEDLAG and so on, but it's a necessary sound debate that needs to take place at a broader policy level. I agree that I've also had, I think Mr. Smith can also attest to some of these concerns that have been raised, the question of the appropriateness of or levels of the representatives that are being sent to NEDLAG. Again, what you would need there, you would need parties at NEDLAG level or within the context of social dialogue being able to sit around the table and say, what is it, if we take NEDLAG seriously, what is it that we need to do to demonstrate our seriousness towards the issue of social dialogue in South Africa and so forth. I think that's also a discussion that would have to take place at that level. I think there's a question that I saw. No, let me stand down for now, Chair, around these broader questions that I wanted to respond to, and ask that our colleagues from the CCMA, UIF, NEDLAG as well, as the colleagues, the IES, PES, on the ESSA question and Productivity SA, also tackle some of the questions that have been specifically post. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will respond to the question around our visibility in the rural areas and the fact that it's valid. It's a valid observation that we are not visible in rural areas. And it's also valid that they may township boy. But the key thing around this is something we have observed, but the question is, what are we doing about it? The first thing is, when you look at the slide number 33, where we're trying to explain our state of funding, the observation would indicate that the salary bill is 36 million. And then when you look at the grant funding, it's about the same amount of money. So the question is, as funding grows, what do we do? And as Productivity SA would prefer a situation where as we get more funding, we employ more people that can be on the ground and implement our interventions. With regard to issue of what are we doing in the medium term, we'll be looking at working with labor centers of the Department of Labor in terms of assisting us in terms of creating awareness about what Productivity SA interventions are all about. And in the long term, as funding improves, then we will look at setting up offices. But we believe that the approach we are taking has got a bigger impact, much as it does not immediately deal with the issue of visibility. And with regard to partnerships, if you look at the partnership that we have with SANACO, CEDA, and LEADED, those are the kind of partnerships that are assisting us in terms of reaching the rural areas we would otherwise not be able to reach with our level of funding. For an example, we have been able to go to areas such as Msinga, Torrenby, Zanini, Kwakwa, etc. And as we form more partnerships, we'll be able to reach more areas and be able to increase our level of visibility. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. In relation to the questions directed to CCMA, firstly by the Honourable van der Westhuizen, asking the CCMA in relation to the proposed amendments. Obviously, the word proposed is important because some of them are not defined as yet and they're still in a work in progress. But the CCMA is working together with all the social partners and particularly the Department of Labour and National Treasury to make sure that it's ready and can implement the process in relation to that. Obviously, by using the word National Treasury, I imply that the amendments do envisage that the CCMA will need to probably have more increased funding, and we would have to look at that process, but we are working together with the Department of Labour to try and make sure that we are prepared and ready for the process in relation to that. And I'm sure we will try and, you know, it's hard to always predict what's going to happen in relation to that, but we will try and do that, and obviously commit it as the CCMA to make sure that we deal with the issues as succinctly and quickly as we have been in our other issues and efficiencies in relation to that. And then, Chairperson, the question that you asked in relation to the alleged surplus. The CCMA specifically put that slide up because the going concern issue has been a matter of public concern, and obviously the committee has regularly asked it. And so we wanted to not come here and not deal with financial issues and so just gloss over it. That represents the process up to the end of February, and obviously we haven't closed our financial year off. We have a whole host of accounts we're expecting to come in, and the key issue was to show that we've actually reduced down our deficit and we're in a much better financial position than we have been in the last 3-4 years given the work that we've done in relation to that. We're not anticipating having a surplus at the when the actual financials come out at the end of the year. We're anticipating breaking even within a range in relation to that. I trust that clarifies the question. Thanks very much.
I will deal with the question that you raised, Chairperson, on the 4.6. There are two issues there. The one is the briefing documents. It's actually the South African government's position on the issues that will be discussed at the ARLAC Governing Council. Now, ARLAC is the African Regional Labour Administration Centre. We are members of that body together with 18 other English-speaking African countries. And really what we are doing here is that there are two meetings a year. The one is in February, which has already taken place, and the other one is in June, which is coinciding with the ILO conference. It's on the side of the ILO conference. And what we then do is when we receive the documentation for that meeting, we then have to prepare South Africa's position on the items that will be discussed in that Governing Council meeting. So we have to do that by May so as to enable the minister and her delegation that will attend the meeting to participate in that meeting. And that line function responsibility is with the Program 4. So that is work that needs to be done. The second one, dealing with SADC, Employment and Labour Sector, it is April now, and the direct answer to your question is whether this has been done. It's been done because the SADC Employment and Labour Sector meeting meets from Monday, the 23rd, coming Monday, until the 27th, the end of next week in Angola. And again, the minister will be attending this meeting. There are a number of issues that will be discussed there. Let me just give you an idea of some of the matters that will be discussed. entrepreneurship in the SADC economy, the SADC decent work program. There'll be a draft employment and labor protocol, which is a legal instrument where we have to do work with the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, as well as the legal section of the Department of International Relations and Cooperation, on whether this legal instrument is consistent with our domestic legislation and so on. And then there will also be discussions around SADC member states' participation in the ILO governing body, where there will be a report. And the key one there would be that the ILO will be electing a new director general this year, and we'll get feedback from our governing body members as to the candidates that have been assessed during the last governing body meeting, because there'll be election on the 28th of May of a new ILO director general. And SADC will then have to discuss what its position would be when it comes to participation in the election of the ILO director general. So our positions, South African positions, need to be prepared on those issues so that when we participate in the employment and labor sector, we are making an effective input there and participation in that. So that is really the work that is being raised here in the strategic plan that has to be done by Program 4, as that is their line function responsibilities. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair.
Just say your name so that for recording purposes.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Jake Malatse from the Inspection and Enforcement Services. I'm going to be responding to the two questions relating to IES. The two questions talks to the issue of capacity building and also the vacancies. I'll start with the last one. In terms of the vacancies, as at March, the 1st of March 2012, the total post in the inspectorate for inspectors is 1098. And the filled post as at that time is 1011. Those are the filled posts. And then the vacant posts, it's 84 vacant posts in the inspectorate for inspectors. That brings us to a vacancy rate of 7.67. Going to the question relating to the capacity in the inspectorate, the first thing is that we are recruiting inspectors with the requisite qualifications, that is, inspectors with diplomas and degrees in labor law, and also inspectors with degrees or diplomas in the natural science and engineering. And then the second thing is that we have already started, Chairperson, with a six-month induction program in the inspectorate. We started last year by training inspectors with the requisite qualification, but inducting them into the processes and the laws of the department. The third one is that we are also conducting functional training for inspectors, that is, training inspectors on the relevant legislation, regulations, on relevant standards, SABS standards, because we're also incorporating standards that the inspectors must enforce, which are technical, electrical, mechanical, and hygiene. The other last point in terms of capacity is that we are managing the triple inspector program effectively. We've started to manage that program to see that when inspectors finish, we then transfer them to the relevant labor centers. I think about a month ago, we have moved about 3 to 4 inspectors that qualified to a labor center in Haudi. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll deal with the questions that you've asked yourself and also Mr. van der Westhuizen. I think the first question was overpayment. The other name for overpayment is work and draw. It is when a beneficiary has gone back to work but continues to claim UI. So it becomes a debt to us that we need to collect. So it's a debt from our side. The other question was on the reserves, why they are growing. Your reserves are actually allocations that you make to secure your future liabilities. if you anticipate that you're going to have a lot of claims, then your reserve must actually grow. So they are actually necessary that you need to have that, and I also need to indicate that what we allocate with regard to reserve is what the actuaries tell us. They look into the future and say this is what you can expect. So they're actually necessary for us to ensure that when people come to claim, they have their money. I think the other question that you have put forward is that is the growth in reserves or assets costing the fund jobs? On the contrary, the UIF at this point in time has got 65 billion, and that 65 billion is invested in different asset instruments. The first one is the government bonds, and the government use that for job creation when they build hospitals. And the other one for the parastatals, for instance, we have money that you put with the land bank. Farmers, when they want to expand their farms, they go to the land bank. The money also comes from the UIF. You also have our money sitting in the banks, you know, in the form of bonds. So when people want to borrow, they go to the banks and they get this money. So we're involved in job creation to a very large extent. The other thing that if you have more money, it actually gives you an opportunity to improve benefits. Hence, the DG has indicated that there's a move towards that. Of course, we will need the legislation to help us to be able to do that. So the process will eventually come to Parliament. At this point in time, the state law advisor has looked into our bill, and they said it is constitutional and it has to go forward. So those are the questions that you've asked. Chairperson, you asked the issue of fraud in the funds. Quite difficult questions in terms of the numbers. There are cases that we have identified is 286, and most cases refers to work and draw, because we say if people are back at work, they should not continue to claim the UIF. Other cases relate to employers when they take contributions from employees, but they don't put them forward. Now, how we find that is that when people come to claim, we check in our system and we realize that there is no contribution, and then IES will help to go out and try to get these employers to pay the money to the UIF. The other fraud that we find is the collusion between our employees and the people from outside, where, for instance, they give you a fictitious declaration that says, Mr. Sirua has worked for 4 years, only to find that I'm not working in that company. We also find that when you compare information in your database, and for that kind of fraud, we in the KwaZulu-Natal, 4 officials have been arrested, they've been dismissed and arrested, and also the Asset Forfeiture Unit is pursuing them to be able to recover the money. In Eastern Cape, we have dismissed 2 employees, and the Hawks are actually looking into the issues of crime in that regard. In Northern Cape, 1 person was dismissed based on that fraud. But what we're saying is that prevention is better than cure. That's why you have an automatic fraud detection system that you put in place so that it can actually prevent this fraud from taking place. Thank you.
Thanks, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. I'll deal with the employment services related question from Honorable Mashele. I think the question relates to the numbers that we have compared to levels of unemployment in the country. I must be the first to admit that the numbers are low. The levels of unemployment is high in the country. But the issue is that there are many players involved in trying to address the scourge of unemployment, and especially amongst young people in this country, and that as the department were asked to also come up with a contribution. And our targets were based on the previous trends that we've looked at, and I think there are a number of reasons why we revised the targets to be that. Among the reasons that one can advance and share with honorable members insofar as our database is concerned, is that firstly, you do find a high number of companies registering jobs that requires high levels of skills and people with experience. On the other hand, we also have a large, very, very large number of people with very low skills levels, low experience, that cannot match any of the jobs that are on the system. And those in the majority are people that require a lot of training. And that is where, through our career counseling and referral systems, we refer the large number of those people to the Department of Education. Honorable members will remember that we used to have instruments such as the National Skills Fund, the Umsobomvu Youth Fund, where we used to refer and cater for the large number of those young people that came to our offices. Those instruments are no longer in the department, and that the currently we rely on the NYDA through the partnership agreement that we have, the Department of Higher Education, and so on, to take on those young people. But you also have a second layer of young people with qualifications, graduates, that also find it very difficult to find employment because they don't have the necessary experience that is required in some companies. And those, in most cases, with the learnership and internship programs that we refer through counseling and so on, the majority of them are fortunate enough to also get formal employment. But I must also admit that we also have capacity constraints. We also have IT challenges because where you have, if we can capture at the rate at which we would want to, the number of vacancies and the applications coming to us, because the system is automated to do the matching. And we are hoping that with the interventions that are in place to address the IT challenges, we will be able to improve those numbers. The other point, Honorable Chairperson, that you raised was how do we compare with other agencies that are operating within the similar vein. The private employment agencies that operate in this area are commercial, and in most cases, the target market that comes to us do not make a lot of money to them, and they don't address, in most cases, that category. They tend to focus mainly in the higher end, where somebody is employed, they get a job, and they poach that person, place them in another sector, and out of that successful placement is when they make the necessary income, or they charge either the individual for successful placement, or they also charge the company that employs the person. Where they tend to focus on the lower skills end, it tends to be in the undreaded area that I wouldn't want to go into, the labor brokerage area, and that's a difficult one because the relationships there are completely different. But as part of our long term, is that the Employment Services Bill contains provision for schemes. There's a funding component, and we believe that with the passage of the bill, it will allow us to extend our scope. It will give us certain powers to work with the temporary employment agencies as well. But also, it will bring in the funding arrangements, and it will also make sure that we have the necessary capacity and we are able to move towards agencies that offer similar services in other countries. Thank you.
Mr. Smith. Thank you, Honorable Chair. Chair, I think it's important. I'm going to just give, a very general response, and I think want to echo what the DG has already said. But I think it's important that we must guard against a sort of doom and gloom scenario. And if I've created that impression, then I must apologize. In fact, I think that there's a hell of a lot of opportunity and scope for NEDLAC in the current era. So I don't think it's a question of relevance. I think part of the issue is that we are going through a very difficult period, or I don't know, years ago we used to talk about the conjuncture. But I think both from a political point of view as well as a socio-economic point of view, there are a number of factors which have come together in the last year at least that I think are impacting quite heavily on the various constituencies and social partners. And this uncertainty, I think, reflects itself in the pressures that are placed on a number of our institutions, NEDLAC included. But NEDLAC is at the forefront of a lot of these engagements and the sort of potential tensions between the various social partners. It's precisely why we have social dialogue. It is to, I think, ultimately try to channel and absorb social conflicts and to deal with social conflicts in a more constructive way. So I think we need to be perhaps, and we need to have a bigger discussion around this, but I think before we talk about sort of doing away with NEDLAC, we should think about what the alternatives are. And I'm afraid I think those alternatives are quite bleak. So I don't think it's a matter of doing away with NEDLAC. I don't think it's a matter of the relevance of NEDLAC. I think it's more relevant than ever. It is a question of how do we reposition the institution. And I think we must accept that a decade and a half into our democracy, things have changed, and our institutions also need to evolve. And so it is, I think, that some to some extent a natural process of adaptation and change that we need to embark on. Clearly, we can't do everything overnight, which is why we have strategic frameworks and strategic plans so that we can focus on the priorities that we need to do in the short term as well as have clear objectives in the medium term. So when we look at our strat plan, and our strat plan is not the be-all and end-all, as I said at the beginning, it's the first cut and it's the first time that as social partners in that, like, we've engaged with this new framework. But it attempts to set a foundation for dealing with the very complex challenges that faces NEDLAC and social dialogue, and in a way it reflects the complex challenges that we face as a society. And so there are a number of factors that impact on the quality of social dialogue. One of the key issues is the question of vision and leadership, which I think is what the DG has alluded to. Stakeholder capacity and stakeholder commitment, the commitment of social partners to dialogue, is crucial. The capacity of the institution itself is absolutely crucial. These issues are impacted on by the political context, by the socioeconomic context. So it's a dynamic process and it's going to change all the time. Now, the plan is suggesting that in the short term, we focus on the organizational renewal. So we upgrade the capacity of the secretariat, including dealing, for example, if you want, with the rules of engagement, which is why we are locating the protocol document at the center of our short-term approach. And that is saying, let's clarify the protocol document so that all the social partners, the parliament, all the other institutions that we liaise with are clear about the rules of engagement. And I think over the years, those rules have perhaps become a bit blurry. We need to refocus and understand. And the documents that have been proposed are very clear. There are clear time frames. There are clear rules for how things need to be dealt with. And I think what we need to try and do is build the accountability and the adherence to that document in the short term. And I think that is eminently possible. From a secretarial point of view, again, it's improving the quality of the administration and the quality of the facilitation in particular. And I think that in the short term, that will make a difference. It obviously doesn't address the issue of the tensions, which are obviously quite serious between social partners. They will come and they will go. But this is why I think the issue of vision and leadership is so important. And we are saying that in the medium term, we obviously need to address that. And I think we must all perhaps be quite frank that in the current period, we're going through a period of turbulence. We need to sort of tighten our seatbelts. We need to keep cool heads.
and we need to sort of focus, as you said, as the member has said, focus on the basics, and this period of turbulence will pass. I think, Chair, that I'm quite excited, and I think that MEDLAC is more relevant than before. The question around the sort of minister and the background to that, I mean, I don't think I can go into that. The minister obviously has her reasons. But again, I think we should not perhaps exaggerate the issue. I think that, again, if we keep cool minds, there is nothing that says that the minister cannot proceed unless this issue has been finalized in the MEDLAC report. The minister has indicated her frustration in the past. So I think that in the end, we all are going to have to come together again and address this particular issue, and I think that's the reality. And I don't think it's going to help much that we sort of focus on. Chair, I think that's where I will end. Thanks.
Any addition to the answers? Okay. I've got some few questions. Are we moving? And what are we doing with them? How are we doing with them? We still have three questions. Let's take a second round of questions before we close. From the CCMA, there was talk about extending services to communities, that is opening new offices in other areas. How are we doing with that? You know, how many new offices have we opened? And in this financial year, what is our plan in terms of expanding or decentralizing the work to the region? The CCM in their presentation, this emphasis on the negative history of adversarial relationship between labor and capital, that employer and employees, discussions always happen in, you know, when we negotiate and discuss, we do this at different wavelengths, and that is where the CCMA comes in looking at the relationships and laying itself as a golden bridge between these two classes, sectors, I meant to say. There's no difference in the same anyway. What role are we playing? What new role are we playing in deepening the service? That is, deepening and broadening our area of work in terms of creating peace between the employers and employees. Some cases get referred to other divisions within the justice cluster. Is it maybe easier to refer cases there? You know, it's minus a lot of work for you, so you just refer it to the industrial court, refer this one somewhere. So I just want to check, is it too easy to refer this to? The measures we have in the CCMA to embolden qualitative collective bargaining within the sectors. How are we doing with them? We're looking at the depth of our intervention during and even before conflict arise. We know there's a season called the strike season. Do we have mechanism of making those interventions even before the season starts? Where do we start with those processes to ensure that we have a peaceful resolution, where possible, of industrial disputes? That is all from me about the CCMA. Let me go over to Honorable van der Westhuizen.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Just a question, but may I first just respond to the official who said that money in reserves actually contributes to job creation in this country. So can we please have a discussion on the economics of a country and how jobs are created, because taxing people, because the levies are actually a form of taxes, is not the way to create jobs. We must keep the money in the economy so that entrepreneurs can create those jobs for us. But my next question is just, I'm glad to have heard this morning that various organizations, institutions of the department intervene when strikes are imminent or when job losses are faced. One of the biggest strikes that this country has seen happened in the first quarter of this year at Implats, where 17,000 people eventually were retrenched, and where millions and millions of money for this country was lost, and again, you know, to the detriment of growing this economy. And my question has just been, has the department been involved in that? Has the department done any studies? What has gone wrong there? Because really, it has been most damaging to the South African economy. Thank you.
Can I jump onto the productivity essay and ask a question about it? There's a statement that the typical small business employs 12 people at most, excluding the owner manager. Now, what I want to check is how many SMEs have we helped in this sector? I mean, you know, as the first productivity essay, because it says that the SMMEs employs more than 5.3 million people, according to a statement. You know, how many interventions have we made? How many jobs have we saved in this sector? And what support are we giving to this sector to ensure that they, you know, they can sustain themselves? And what are the challenges facing the SMMEs? I think that too will be very Brasesh.
Thank you, Chair. The last question you posed was going to be one of mine, but that's fine. So we'll park that one. CCMA, just when you thought, you know, I wasn't going to refer to you. I was struck by the breaking even within a range. You know, so you listen to all this economic talk about how the rand sort of moving within a range. I thought that was quite a nice one. But good luck with the break-even thing, because nobody wants to be in debt. However, my point is actually a very positive one in this regard. You referred in your presentation to a 94% user confidence in the system. Now, that's quite remarkable. That's quite remarkable. And listening to your presentation, I picked up expressions like, we are working hard to entrench the CCMA's role in the labor market. You said this several times. And you said something else again, measurement performance measurement. Now, I think these are the words I would like to hear. I would like to hear this kind of thing. So I'm asking you, the success factor, because it is a success story. Something is working here. How do you get it right? Is there anything that our colleagues could learn from there, take away, so that we can have a success factor over 90% for all our entities here? That's the first question. The second question, and of course it'd be the last one. No, second question has to do with the registration, UIF, registration of employers for UIF. You are targeting 5% this year. How big is the problem? Why are these people not registering? You know, what should we do to them? We need to have people register. People need to draw benefits. What are we doing about it? Does it have to do with the fact that we can't inspect them properly? How are we going to do that? Please, guys. Let's go back to to NEDLAC. DG, my concern, our concern with NEDLAC is not that we should scrap it and whatever. We're saying NEDLAC should be the tripartite alliance. That's what NEDLAC should be. People should go knowing that when you go into NEDLAC, every one of those three entities, the major ones, we know there are other social partners, committees, they are fine. But we have government, we have labor, we have business. These three entities need to go into NEDLAC with one common vision. South Africa must work. We seem to have lost. Where did we lose it? Where did we go wrong? Thank you.
Honorable Makubela Mashedi.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think it's only correct that we applaud UIF for exceeding their target on employing women in senior management positions. I think it's a step towards the right direction, and we should applaud you, Commissioner. And then my question will go to the Inspection Enforcement Services, IES. You know, from the experience that we got moving or doing our own site visits into sectors and workplaces, we found that your target, I think this goes to three provinces that we visited, that your targets are based on the existing employers that you know. You do not break new ground. You do not go to workplaces or farms that you do not know about, or I assume you do not know about, because when we go out there and have our own samples of the workplaces that we'll go to and the farms that we'd go to, we'd be confronted with a situation that they have never seen an inspector for the period of 5 years, or they have never seen an inspector for the rest of the existence of the farm. And it's all good that you come here, you give us your success rate, and it's always the numbers of the targeted inspections that you've done in all the provinces is very high. It's above 80%. But the problem that I have is that this is per the existing database that you have. You do not go to areas that you do not know to. If there's a workshop somewhere in the middle of nowhere, or a farm that is somewhere, I don't know how you would not get to know those farms, because those farms are there on the map. You know, we've even suggested in Free State that they should go to Statistics SA, because they've got maps and they do their surveys in all parts of the country. They've got maps that depicts every space on the ground. And I just want to know here, you know, what is it that you are doing? Because it's one thing to tell us your success and your targets that you are actually achieving. But what about those places that you do not actually go there? Because we have seen them. Here in the Western Cape, we'll talk about four farms. There's a very huge farm that the Lovren brothers, where they do not even know what an employment equity plan is. They've never heard of that, and they've never seen an inspector come to their place. And we asked them for how long, and they said it's a period of more than 5 years. The last time an inspector came here was when the farm was still in the hands of others, and they do not know exactly when, but it's it's beyond 5 years. So my question would be, how are we actually going to go about actually making sure that your targets and the work that you do actually includes all the areas that you have not broken to the new ground? And then the issue of inspectors, you know, you have a situation where the OHS inspectors, you'd only find one inspector, maybe one inspector in a province. And how do you then expect that one person to be moving in all the districts and all the regions of that province? Are they going to do justice to the work that they are doing? Or at the end of the day, they'll be so overworked to a point that they'll just do what they can do and not actually cover the chunk of work that would want them to do. Thanks, Chairperson.
Honorable Makubela Mashele, the four cousins haven't seen a labor inspector. It's a popular drink in the township, the four cousins. But they haven't seen a labor inspector in the entire life. It's quite a shame. I think we need to look at, you know, we need to look at, go to areas that we have never been to, rather than going to all areas where we know, you know, maybe they're on the roadside, not far from the third road. We need to go deep and drill deep rural areas to reach those that we have never reached. Are there other questions before we... No, thanks. let me take this opportunity to thank everybody, particularly the chairpersons of the boards and members of the board of the entities who are here for making time to come to this meeting. We feel honored because, you know, if you call the board and they turn up, it means they're really taking you seriously, that they appreciate the kind of work you do. And we appreciate that. Thank you very much. We hope to meet you again whenever we have meetings that deals with strategic issues. We will invite you. And thank you again. DG and your management team and the commissioners, thank you very much. You have stick to the set times in terms of our program for the day. And this time we got the presentations on time. We had enough time to go through them. Let me say thank you. Gaspedi wa relayabu kwa hao. Spedi astolo kwa bahomana. Thank you very much. Members of the committee, thank you. Thank you. I don't need to thank you. Yeah. Now there's a question of time. We're saying that some of the questions we'll redraft them. We'll write them. We'll send them to the departments in writing. Is there still some time?
Hi.
It's not 30 minutes. It's a hero choice. I'm ready to choose. Okay. I'm driving at 120 in a 60 zone. Thank you very much. Now let's run through the answers. But these questions are going to be presented to the department to get the answers in writing. Thank you very much. DG, over to you.
No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, and honorable members. I'll take you probably two questions, but the other question, one of the two questions, I think our person from IES will also come into it. But I think the question is about capacity, and I think that was the last question. One of the things that we're beginning to do, Chair, is
is to interrogate through a project approach the issue of the desired levels of capacity that we need to build within the inspectorate so that we are able to expand the service. Now, but some of us do argue the point that when we deal with capacity, perhaps we need to look at a segmented approach. You may be probably talking about three focal points. One of them is that, of course, there is capacity in terms of increasing the number of people that we inspect for it. But the number itself is not a solution to the problem. There is also the question of increasing capacity in terms of specialization, in ensuring that you have the desired sort of levels of skills to be able to dispense this kind of a service from a knowledgeable kind of angle. That's one area. The third area, there is a question of capacity in terms of activating other role players that should be able to supplement our work. For instance, advocacy is one of those areas. For instance, if we talk about creating a health and safety kind of environment, it's not just simply the Department of Labor that has got to do that. It's actually everybody involved. That would include employers, employees, and with relevant formations there and so forth. So those are the things that we're beginning to look into around the issues of capacity. But I think we should try and veer away from an understanding that if we increase the number of inspectors, it means we'll cover each and every corner in the country. It's actually not possible. So I think that's the one point. The issue, Honourable Member Motau, about NEDLAC. Look, I said earlier on that NEDLAC is informed by a concept in the world that is known as a social parliament concept. Now, for instance, what that means is that everybody has recognized that there are parliaments, as you have one here, that are politically constituted from a constitutional point of view in whatever form. But that does not mean that people are an alliance. I'm sure that's your experience here, sir. That you operate within the parliamentary context, but it doesn't mean that all different parties here are basically one alliance of sorts and so forth. Now, the nature of our socio-economic circumstances, broadly speaking, is that we have different role players in that space. So you have business. Business will always pursue whatever set of objectives and interests that it has got. The same thing also with government, the same thing with labor and community, broadly speaking. And there will always be different points of views, and those views would be contested in one form or the other. However, what is important is the extent to which the differing points of views are being managed. And that's where I think your point is correct for the sake of the country. but it would also be, I think, dangerous to, how do I put it? Because if you talk about, NEDLAC should ideally be a tripartite alliance, I think that for me that sounds quite political. And I think we can't afford to make NEDLAC a political institution per se. I don't think that would be ideal. But having said so, I think it's correct, perhaps the point that you're raising, it's correct that this point has got to be subjected to a broader discussion around the question. And I like how Mr. Smith coins it, the question of how I think you said adaptation. There's another term that you said, in English. What are the, yeah. I mean, it's very educated, that person. So, yeah, you said something in English, but it's about adaptation and about ensuring that NEDLAC continues to play this kind of role that it should be played. So it's part of the broader discussion and debate at that level. So I think generally all of us should actually welcome that. At this point, Chair, I would then ask the UIF, before the UIF, I think let's ask the CCMA as well as the UIF to also respond to some of the issues. And I think the issue about CCMA is the implants strike and whether or not we play a role there and so forth. So I'll ask the CCMA chair to respond to that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, DG. There were quite a list of questions, but let me start with the implants question and then answer some other questions between myself, the chairperson of the governing body, and the person responsible for mediation, but there were questions after the chair. Let me start and issue the question in relation to the implant strike. Obviously, the CCMA would have played a very significant role in relation to that process, and we were in many ways trying to assist all the time in that strike, and we are still dealing with a whole lot of dismissals that arose out of that, so that's just to put it in that context. In addition to that, in terms of a national strike of that importance, it's a matter of public interest. The CCMA would, in terms of the law, make offers of attempts to intervene. But as the law stands right now, those offers have to be accepted by both social partners who are involved, both business and labor. That didn't happen in the circumstances. We did make more than three offers during the strike. We cannot then step in and do anything more in relation to that. I think what's positive to report is that following on from there, the board of the organization commissioned a report, and the people involved in that asked the CCMA to be part of that team, and we're busy involved in interviewing and investigating and looking into what the issues are. And I think on the main investigator, to summarize it, is it was a case of employee relations gone really wrong, when everybody knew each other really, really well, and they actually forgot about the people that they were representing. And hopefully we can move on and try and find some good learnings from that. And so I'm sure we'll get a positive report shortly in relation to that. Chair, may I continue and answer that, some of the other questions that were raised? I think the Chair asked about the expansion of the CCMA offices. We've just recently opened our Rustenburg office, which is an expansion issue. We haven't got direct plans right now to open any more bricks and mortar offices, but it's very important to remind everyone that we're working in relation to the CCMA case management system and making sure that case management system, and it is now available in all the Department of Labor offices and their labor centers, so any worker can go in and find out about their case in relation to that. And in addition to that, all commissioners obviously travel out into rural areas and make sure that they, when they're doing their cases, they are visible, and if they also take time to take on board cases or through our dispute management department, work with the Department of Labor and do Imbizo visits and give talks in relation to our work. So we're looking at that. We're not looking only at bricks and mortar solutions, and we're looking at a whole lot of innovative IT-related solutions to try and make sure we can be more accessible in relation to that. There was a question asked briefly around the negativity in relation to historical relationships. And the CCMA is there to manage that negativity, and we would like to argue that we're playing a very important role in trying to ensure, and those statistics have been put forward, in actually ensuring that the relationship between capital and labor, that there is a managed process. That is the key thing. It's not ever going to go away. It's like a marriage. I mean, people always fight in their marriage, but they're sorted out in the end. The CCMA is there just to mediate in relation to that. We have a strong dispute management and prevention department who works both with business and with labor, training, giving advice, supporting people, doing special interventions, etc., to try and avoid any of the disputes before they come to the CCMA. And I gave the private security industry as an example. There are plenty of other sectors where the CCMA, since 2006, has very significantly helped those parties in a vulnerable sector and partly underrepresented to make sure that they actually assist in doing the process on that. There was a question asked about cases being referred away to the CCMA. Cases can't be referred away from the CCMA. We always accept cases. I think it might be in relation to the Labour Court, but that's because of what the law says in relation to that. I'm going to ask the National Senior Commissioner for Mediation and Capacity Building, sorry, Collective Bargaining, Asil Subedar, just to take you through what we do in relation to preparation for, I know the chairperson called it strike season. We would like to call it collective bargaining season because it's much more important. And he'll take you through what we're doing in relation to that. Thanks, Asil. And then I'll hand to the chair.
Thank you, Chair. We've been, since 2007, capacitating commissioners to deal with the collective bargaining season. On the 15th of May this year, for example, like we've done for the past 5 years, we'll conduct a briefing for commissioners. At that briefing, we have presentations by a labor economist who basically takes us through the economic landscape in which the context in which bargaining will take place. We then also have presentations from the different social partners, especially business and labor, giving us what their perceptions of the coming collective bargaining season are. And this is really so that our commissioners can better understand the demands and the response to demands. We then, during the course of the collective bargaining season, very actively use Section 150, in terms of which we make active offers of assistance to parties. And whereas we used to have a wait-and-see approach with these things, we've now become a lot more proactive in the sense that we, one of our key performance areas is 1.7 under Strategic Objective 1, and that is to assist, support, and promote collective bargaining. So this goes beyond purely the dispute resolution and the kind of work that we've done in the private security sector and that we hope to do in the legislative sector as well bears testimony to that. So during the course of the collective bargaining season, we have a very intensive intelligence gathering system on the ground, being able to deploy commissioners very quickly into situations where there's escalating conflict. Once the collective bargaining season is over, we have a debriefing session as well, during which we basically discuss exactly what went down and in that way draw learnings and further capacitate our commissioners. So, yeah, that's in a very small nutshell what we do to support the economy by supporting collective bargaining. Thank you, Chair.
I'll just address the last question, which is a very nice question for me to address in terms of some of the success factors, and I think particularly what are the learnings. I think that we have been on a very steep learning curve as an organization from its implementation. We're only 15 years old. And I think what we've always said is that, you know, the first few years were about actually just keeping going, and then there was a strong period of time where it was about forming, and we then went through a period of time in terms of embedding, and now we're in the time when the organization is really looking at performance and focusing on that. And I think in trying to describe it simply is that both horizontally and vertically through the organization there's a constant pressure in terms of both capacity and commitment. And I say pressure on commitment, but the reality is that CCMA is really blessed with, right from the governing body to the directors, to the management team, many of the senior management team that are here with us, and the staff and the commissioners, of having people that are fundamentally committed to the vision of the CCMA and what it does. And we see it time and time again, you know, particularly in the governing body, which you know, it might surprise parties, but we're social partners from very, very different perspectives and backgrounds, put aside their differences and look at the interests of the institution. And we think that that is the starting point. It's the fundamental starting point. After that, there's all the good practices that we require to do in terms of PFMA and any good business will have, in terms of making sure that you set your targets and that you manage your targets and you monitor and you adjust. But I think fundamentally what it comes back to is the commitment to the institution. And we're very fortunate in that regard. So we always say well done from the governing body, because management and the leadership, it comes from the top. Thank you.
Thank you.
inspection.
With regards to the question on the new areas, I must maybe start by saying that, yes, we are not touching every place in South Africa for many other reasons. One of them is the question of capacity in terms of the numbers themselves. And as the DG has said, even if when you have the numbers, you cannot reach everywhere. You need to use other tactics. In terms of the work that we're doing, we have inspection modes that we embark on. Firstly, we do routine inspections. And then secondly, we also have identified what we call problematic and high-risk sectors. Those are the sectors that have high incident rates, and we cannot ignore those sectors. So we have a strategy for that in terms of dealing with that, in terms of our audits, in terms of our inspections. And then also the problematic sectors. We are also doing what we call blitz inspections for those problematic sectors. But again, we have, in 2010, started with what we call the RSR, the Roving Health and Safety Rep. The Roving Health and Safety Rep is a worker himself or herself working in a group of farms doing inspections. And that rep, there has been an agreement among the farms around that area whereby they say this is our inspector, the worker becomes an inspector. And that worker is trained by the Department of Labor. That worker was trained by the Department of Labor. We have done area, we have done Mpumalanga and Limpopo. Those were the two areas. And then we now come to other two provinces such as, I think, the Northern Cape and the Western Cape. So those are some of the strategies that we are trying to embark on in terms of covering, having a bigger coverage. We do acknowledge that this is a problem of touching each and every area, but we're coming up with strategies addressing those particular issues. One of the other strategies that we are using is that we are using communications, because we know that when we start to communicate, we can then now capture broader areas. We are doing seminars, we are doing road shows, we are training also shop stewards, and doing workshops with other stakeholders on our legislation. And I think those other strategies also help us to capture a broader area. We acknowledge that we cannot capture everything, but we are trying to get there. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable members, all your questions covered.
Thank you, Chair. May I just have a last remark? I yesterday attended the briefing session by the department on the bills that are currently before Parliament. And if I may request the department on behalf of the Portfolio Committee, what did trouble me was that to a large extent the presentation dealt with the bills as if they have been legislated already. And I would like you to request the presenter to refer people and to encourage them to make part of the public participation process here at Parliament, the hearings that we will have on the legislation, and perhaps even give them, as part of the presentation, the contact details of the committee secretary. They quite rightly said it's a briefing session, it's not a public hearing session, but people will still have the opportunity to approach Parliament, and I would love the department to work with Parliament and to encourage people to make use of this process, and to also make it easy for them by saying to them, any written submissions, any presentations that they would like to make, this is the person at Parliament to contact. If that may carry your approval, I'll appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Honourable Member. Let me afford the Commissioner, Mr. Sirua, and Productivity SA to come in and have the last bite.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm responding to a question on registration. I just need to indicate that the biggest challenge that we face is in the informal sector. In the formal sector, we have a maximum compliance. The sectors which are a bit problematic is the taxi industry, employers of domestic workers, and also sponsor shop and small businesses. And we have realized that also, although the farming community can also be regarded as an informal sector, because they work in a seasonal manner, but we have seen an increase in compliance in that area when the minister was doing her police inspection. Now, what are the strategies that we are employing to address this thing? The first one is the enforcement inspection process. We believe that it's quite giving positive results. We also do advocacy, where we communicate. I've indicated in my strategic plan that we want to reach 20 million people. That's where we educate workers about their rights and also indicate to them to say they can phone our call center, give us their ID. We can see whether they are covered or not. They're not covered by the UIF. But the other thing is to come with a technology that will make easy for people to register and also to comply with the registration. Lastly, is the issue of advertisement in the media to get the increase in the numbers. Chairperson, I don't want to talk about the issue of economics that has been raised about taxing people, because the honorable member said we can take a discussion outside the meeting. But lastly, I want to appreciate the positive comment that you made on us, and thank you very much for that. Thanks.
Commissioner, can we get to productivity essay?
Thank you, Chairperson. The Honourable Chairperson asked a question around SMME, and it was threefold. The first aspect is how many SMMEs have we assisted, the second one in what way, and then thirdly, what are the challenges facing SMMEs? And the third component, I'll be asking our executive responsible for research to respond on that, because we've conducted research around challenges facing SMME. In terms of the number, for the year ending March 2012, we assisted over 3,700 SMMEs. And then secondly, in what form did we assist them? Firstly, we've run incubation programs in partnership with CEDA as well as Swane LED. And then secondly, we've been extensively involved in capacity building of SMMEs. And SMMEs have been assisted, for an instance, to measure productivity, to reduce operational costs, to establish early warning system, just to look at the drivers within the business and be able to say, if this goes wrong, then it means if I don't address it timeously, my business will go down. And then what we've also been able to do as well is to help them measure and eliminate wastage within their environment, because wastage is a large component of what affects their profitability and therefore their ability to sustain themselves and an ability to create saving that can help them in terms of growing and employing more people. So at this point, I'll hand over to Mr. Musai to broadly outline factors that are affecting SMMEs as per the research he conducted.
Thank you, Chairperson. I will just respond briefly. I've just asked the Executive Director of NEDLAC to share with me in the wealth of the country in terms of the issues that confront the SMMEs are very simple and they are well known. One of them is capital investment. We found that to be prevalent, but also location in relation to the market. What is very relevant to us, which is an issue that was very outstanding, is business process improvement support, which we found that in terms of local government support as well as other support that comes from government, that is offered, but most SMMEs weren't able to access it. That talks to issues that relate to efficiencies, understanding your market, being able to read the standards in terms of quality, in terms of time, and being able to manage your inventory properly so that you don't have your cash flow trapped in your inventory. as well as basically understanding the basic business operations, such as the five P's. I think the, your people, what, how do you respond to them, your prices, your products, etc. So those were the broad issues which were facing SMMEs. And I think that kind of study we shared with SALGA as well as the the other entities that are dealing CEDA, etc. So that we can help them be more focused in terms of helping SMEs. Thank you, Chairperson.
I take it all the questions have been responded, and if there are any, if there were any omissions, I would request the department to still have the questions written in reply form to the secretary. Let me take this opportunity, members of the department and honourable members, to thank everybody for participating in this meeting, for heeding to our call to come and present to us your strategic plans. And it was a fruitful engagement, because all of us are benefiting in the process, because we are all working towards achieving one goal. And well, the chairperson has done most of the thanking part of it. I'm just also doing it with the powers vested in me for this time, because power is a scarce commodity. You can't just get it anywhere. But thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Okay, thank you.
Sorry.